Hello, and welcome to The Unrestricted Area, presented by Basketball Intelligence. Make sure to check out basketballintelligence.net for your daily newsletter curating links to the best NBA reporting and analysis every single day. Today, we'll be discussing some potential NBA rule changes with former NBA Director of Officiating and longtime referee Ronnie Nunn and Bleacher Report's Andy Bailey. It's a fun conversation that takes you into the mind of a referee and hopefully will give you a little more appreciation for everything they have to deal with and consider throughout a game. Enjoy!
Welcome, everyone, to the Unrestricted Area podcast sponsored by Basketball Intelligence. We should have a very interesting topic today. We're going to today look at possible rule changes for the NBA, and this pod was inspired by a story that Andy Bailey wrote for Bleacher Report. And first, let me introduce Andy. Andy was a D1 player and is now
D3,
an attorney.
D3.
My bad.
I appreciate the love, though.
Okay. The D3 player who could have been a D1 player. Okay.
Right.
So, and is now an attorney in Wyoming and writes, as indicated, for Bleacher Report. And recently did, as I indicated, a story about some rule changes he would like to see. We thought it would be a great idea to have Andy talk about those. And since there's so many different perspectives that come into play when rule changes are talked about, whether it's from fans or players or coaches or the league, very specifically today, we want to talk about from an officiating perspective, whether they would work, how they would work, are they the best thing to do, are there problems with it, et cetera, and who better than to enter into that dialogue with Andy Bailey, but our other guest today, Ronnie Nunn, who after a great high school and college career, tried out for the NBA, and then shortly thereafter became an official, I guess, for almost 20 years in the NBA. And then following that became the director of officials for the NBA. And many of you probably encountered him in that capacity where he did a lot of responding to questions from fans, et cetera, and explaining the rules and explaining why things were done a certain way, et cetera. So we're all very grateful to Ronnie for having done that and happy to have him today. So the way we're going to proceed, there are six proposals that Andy made. And Mike or I will introduce each of those very briefly and then let Andy explain exactly what he's proposing and why. And Ronnie can then respond from an official's perspective along the lines that I was just talking about. And then we would encourage a dialogue between them to discuss each of the proposals. So the NBA makes changes in its rules, in my view, a little too slowly. We see a lot of rules that are working great in FIBA, for example, and it takes far too many years, in my view. But finally, the NBA goes around to adopting them. We have the 14-second offensive rebounding rule, for example, the take foul rule that many of us were screaming for a long, long time, but they finally got around to doing it. So one of the FIBA rules that's different from the NBA relates to basket interference. And it's quite different. And I'm going to let Andy describe what he is proposing in regard to the NBA, perhaps copying what FIBA has done quite successfully and why he thinks it would be a good idea to do it. And then again, as we indicated, we're asked Ronnie to respond to that from a officiating perspective and then ask them to have a dialogue on it. So Andy, you want to take over?
Sure. Thank you, Ray and Mike, for having me. And thanks for joining us, Ronnie. Thanks again for inflating my reputation as a basketball.
I hope I've used up all of my mistakes, but we'll see.
No worries. I think generally speaking, the theme, if you want to throw a theme on some of these rule changes that I've proposed, is to improve the flow of the game. And also, and I think Mike alluded to this before we started recording, potentially take some stuff off the official's plate. I don't know if simplify is the right word, because I think an NBA referee's job is always going to be pretty complex and difficult. But any way to help, I think, is a good thing. And I think this slight tweak on goaltending would accomplish that, or at least get us going in that direction. The NBA rule, as I would guess pretty much everybody knows, is you can't block the ball when it's reached its peak and then it's on its way down. But you also can't block it once it's hit the rim and it's above the cylinder or the hoop. In FIBA, you can. As soon as the ball hits the rim, it is live. And you'll see, I don't think it's a ton of times per game, but I would say, I don't know, 4 or 5 times per game when I'm watching FIBA, that play, it comes into play. Sorry to use play twice in the same sentence, but the ball hits the rim and somebody is able to get up there quickly and tap it off. And I think it just kind of improves the flow. It takes at least a couple, maybe 3 or 4 bang bang plays off the referee's plate. So generally speaking, I just kind of like the way it helps the game flow a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. I do wonder if, you know, NBA players being a little bit, in general, the NBA big men are a little bit more athletic than the overseas big men, right? So I know that there is a little bit of a fear that, like, hey, maybe this would become a, issues may not the right word, but it would become a more common practice in the NBA. The flip side of that you don't hear about as much is like, hey, there's an NBA defensive 3-second rule that's keeping a lot of those guys away from the hoop anyway, which you don't have internationally. So those guys are kind of in better position to make a play off the ball anyway. Ronnie, I want to bring this over to you for a second and ask, hey, is this a call that referees find difficult to make throughout the course of the game? The invisible cylinder above the hoop is hard to see, you know, for players and fans. Like, you can't imagine it's much easier for officials. And one nice thing about this rule is it basically just cleans up the gray area. Once the ball hits the rim, it's kind of live action and they can go from there. Is that something you think referees would welcome?
Well, you know, the easy play in refereeing is basket interference. Goaltending actually is tougher because goaltending, as Andy was referring to, is finding where the peak of the ball is or the apex of that ball. Because literally, when it goes to its apex, it's literally on its way down. I mean, it's so momentary, it's at its apex, that it's literally on its way down. That's a tough play for officials on the floor, for the camera, depending on what camera angle you have. So that's a real tough play. Basket interference to me is not a tough play. I think we do a very, very good job dealing with the vibration of a board, the vibration of a rim, the ball bouncing up and being tapped. And everybody knows what that looks like because that's our national culture of understanding basket interference. I think I recalled when I was in the NBA in the directorship role, David Stern came in and said, what do you think about this same question? And I said, well, you know, we have, I think you bring a good point up with the D3s, but I don't think that's the issue. I think we have a lively, athletic group of young men in the NBA, and they can fly to the hoop as well, driving to the hoop, and they can fly to the hoop when it comes to tapping balls in. So I think one of the things we're talking about is contacts. What level of contact are we going to have when we have aggressive play of that nature? And so rebounding would be the first issue. The second issue, well, that's fun. I mean, that's not a real big deal. Like you and I have seen, basket interference is well adjudicated in FIBA. I mean, you mentioned, I think Andy mentioned, you see it about 4 or 5 times a game, and it's good defensively, it's good offensively. It doesn't really seem to matter. I also noticed that in the FIBA environment over the past 20 years, I've been attached to them to a degree, is their bigs are not lively. I don't want to call them plotters, but their bigs are you know, not the type that can really fly to the hoop and create the scenario. I think also to the NBA, with the NBA respect for this, I think they have used this in the D League and G League to just see how it goes from time to time. I haven't kept up on the data on it, but it tells me 2 things. One, that they haven't done it yet, so there's a reason. 2, it could also be the culture. You know, we have a culture in this country about basket interference. And if all of a sudden you start seeing people, you know, tapping balls around the rim that have been bounced onto the rim and up above the cylinder, I think it becomes crazy. I mean, look how crazy it is with travel, how long it took for us to finally put in print. And this happened during my time as director. You know, gathering the ball and taking 2 steps after you gather a ball. I mean, the gather of the ball for traveling in high school and college was really once you gather the ball and 1 foot is down, that became your pivot foot. But when you're in a fluid motion, I mean, basketball has gone back so far that I could recall even making my own high school layups, and that's quite a while ago, where I gathered the ball and then took two steps afterward. So that 0-1-2 has always been thought of as a travel in high school and college. So when we finally put it together and said, this belongs in the rule book. Why? Because everybody does this at the pro level. I think the newer things about, let's say, travel is, you know, it's usually in a straight line. Well, today we have the Euro step, you know, the diagonal moves. We have the James Harden step backs that Walt Frazier used to do himself. You know, that people don't really understand. History's always been there, especially at the pro level. So now I think it's trickling down to where this is basketball's artful movement. And as long as we can appropriate the rule to it, it will make sense to folks. So answer your question about basket interference. I'm sorry to go way around the block that way. I don't see it as an issue. I like it in FIBA. I haven't seen it. I think it's a great play in FIBA. I would encourage to see how we really want to see it, because the kids are long today. They're not box out oriented. You know, there was a lot of boxing out by bigs in the years that I've come up and most of us have seen. Today, the kids are long. They're tall and long. They turn and go to the basket. They don't turn and look for the defender to box out, for their opponent to box out. They just go. So you take the new youngster that's into the league now, the number one pick. I mean, this is a tall kid. He ain't about boxing out because he doesn't have to box out. So it's like having, you know, you get certain players that are 6'10", 6'11", today that are great shooters. And they're long. Everybody is long instead of, I mean, we've got some strong young men, don't misunderstand me, but the game has gone back to a very long look. And I think rebounding and tapping the ball in and what, if that's the case, where we're not going to have brutal body action, then I like basketball interference to go away and give it the FIBA touch.
Yeah. It's definitely something that, like you both alluded to, has kind of been on the league's radar for a long time. And, you know, Ronnie, I like your point that, like, hey, if this is something the league thought was good, this is probably something that they could have implemented a long time ago.
You know, Mike, I would take exception to that only in how long it has taken them to make rule changes that they ultimately made that were apparent to everyone, and everyone from fans to players to coaches to announcers were screaming for forever, and FIBA had done forever, and they finally got around to doing it. So I would take small exception to that.
That's a totally fair point.
I'd like to say one other thing in reflection to the NBA's innovations. Having you know, played basketball and having been under the rules of basketball and having worked with FIBA so long, even before I became a director and I was still on the floor, I did clinics over there. They are very strong traditionalists, much like the NCAA and the high school. They stay with the point. It's really the NBA, and not because I'm part of it, but because I've learned about it, especially through officiating, that it's really the most progressive rule-oriented group in basketball. I mean, they started the 24-second clock. They have the defensive semicircle. They even have the 3-second offensive lane as a result of Will Chamberlain's prowess. I mean, there are things going on, even in the ABA's influence of the 3-point line. There's a lot of things that the NBA has done that is very much on the cutting edge. And because of that, you know, I see people catching up with certain things that occur, either on the FIBA side or not. I like the fact that people are joining together on some things like the transition take foul or the 14 seconds reset of the clock. I like the fact that they're joining together because I'm hoping that they will join together basketball, the rules, because they're very similar everywhere. Why don't we have them more similar than dissimilar? As you know, for example, you play a baseball game, you can play it any way in the world. It's the same rules. I understand soccer, even for the kids, with the exceptions of 4-year-olds or something. It's the same rule. So yeah, I see basketball have these different concepts, and I'm hoping that this interaction between all of us create similar rules everywhere, with some particularly unique exceptions.
Man, I hold
my peace. Go ahead.
I would love to have a thread one other day about the splintering of the basketball rule book and the differences and how it's played around the world. But unfortunately, I think we're not going to have the time for that. One thing we will have the time for, however, is a discussion about timeouts. So one of the things that Andy had proposed was that, hey, the league should be looking at implementing fewer timeouts per team. Most of the changes the league has made over the decades has been to improve the marketability and the watchability of the sport. But the timeouts seemingly have only increased and gotten longer. So, Andy, take it away from there.
Yeah, I think you summarized it pretty well. We looked it up right before we started recording to make sure we all
remembered, but NBA teams each get 7 timeouts right now. And I don't know how practical this one is, because now we're starting to mess with the dollars and cents, because obviously those timeouts are filled with advertisements. But I'm not a huge soccer fan. I sure like watching my kids play, and I'll tune in for the World Cup. But when I do watch soccer, the flow of the game is so good. In its most basic form, soccer and basketball are kind of similar in that there's goals on opposing ends of a wide rectangle, and both teams are going back and forth trying to put the ball opposing goal. In soccer, it really is just a constant flow back and forth for 90 minutes. In basketball, there's a lot more stoppages. And one of those stoppages, of course, are the timeouts, and they're long. I think most teams generally use every timeout that they have. In addition to the team called timeouts, there are TV timeouts that happen over the course of a game. So there's just all these stoppages. Another thing I know that FIBA does is, this is another one, I just don't know how practical it is. When the ball goes out of bounds, they don't have to give the ball to the referee before they pass it in. And that leads to some quicker transition opportunities, which is kind of like soccer. When the ball goes out of bounds, the other guy just runs over, grabs it, chucks it over his head. I feel like these changes that I'm mentioning, I don't think we're going to get down to 0 timeouts like there are in soccer. I don't even know if we're going to get down to 3, which is what I propose in the article. These changes are a little more dramatic than the goaltending one, in my opinion. And I don't think it would happen all at once. But just in general, I know the NBA, since Adam Silver has taken over, there's been some reports about them maybe wanting to get game times to around 2 hours so they could fit it into a tighter TV block. I think reducing timeouts would get them closer to that goal. Starting the game on time would get them closer to that goal. Maybe you replace some of the ad revenue you lose with, you know, stuff that you project onto the floor. I know that gets a little it's a little unseemly to cover all the players in the court and, you know, every surface of your screen in ads, but they're going to want to make up that ad revenue somewhere. But this is another one that it just, to me, is about the flow of the game, you know, condensing it down, which is a stated goal of the NBA. Just get some of that flow that FIBA and soccer have a little bit better.
Yeah, that makes total sense. And I do have some thoughts about this too, and I think we could have a cool conversation about it. But before we get into that, Ronnie, I do want to hear from you a little bit of, like, what are referees using timeouts for? Like, I think all the focus during timeouts is around players and coaches and what they're doing, but I'm sure the referees aren't just sitting there twiddling their thumbs the entire time. So I'm curious as to, you know, what referees are using it for, and whether, you know, in your experience, you thought that the timeout situation was out of control, and whether you'd welcome fewer, that sort of thing.
Well, you know, timeouts, let's first, I never played soccer, so I didn't grow up in a soccer environment, you know, and I don't know how much of the running it is, but I will tell you, basketball is very, very demanding on running. And it's, of course, it's stop and go, but it's sprint and stop and go, and sprint and backwards running and forward running. And it doesn't have that full, you know, launching stride that the soccer has, because gosh darn, the soccer field is tremendously long. But the timeouts were always welcomed. In terms of officiating, when I first started, and you would have a big TNT game or a CBS game or NBC on before we got into, you know, ESPN taking all the other networks that come into play. When we had one of those big games, I was relieved because there were more timeouts. It was like, wow, I can get my breath again. And you know what? Oh, here's another timeout. This is a TNT special, you know, game or one of those CBS network games. So I appreciated the timeouts at the time. Now, what happens at the timeouts really is the official stand, free throw line extended, 2-on-1 when we had, you know, when we had two and three people, when we had two, it was 1-on-1, one free throw line to the other free throw line away from the benches. And if there was something to talk about before we went to those positions, we came together. Normally that is initiated by the crew chief or the lead official, you know. And in my career as a crew chief, I learned from others, of course, that when the crew chief is calling you, there's something to be talked about during this timeout. It could be, for example, post plays getting a little bit of rough, or there's comments by the coach that there is holding Reggie Miller on a pop out from the baseline screen. Let's make sure that that's not happening, because you don't want to lose the trust factor that they have. And sometimes, even though there's talk going on from the benches at times, you've got to keep your ears up, because they may be telling you something you're missing. And that's important. So those kind of meetings were at times, you know, just gathering together the fluidity of the game, some of the chinks in the armor we may have noticed or someone may have noticed. Let's watch for plays going to the hoop. They're driving, looking for fouls. Let's make sure we referee the defense so we validate any calls that we think are there, and we also invalidate any that the contact is marginal into play on. I think the biggest thing is in the last 4 to 2 minute time, when you think about what a team might be trying to do to catch up, those timeouts are very important because, or the last even minute of a game, they're down by 3, they're down by 5. They're calling a timeout. There's a substitution. What does that substitution do when he comes into the game? He will change the look of the game based on what he does. Is he a defensive guy? Is he a three-point shooter? I mean, as you learn this game more and more, referees have to study subs. You know, what does the sub do? What is this sub doing to bring in the game? And it doesn't mean that the sub is a foul affinity type guy or something like that. It's not about this guy is a bruiser versus this guy is this. It's more about what does that person bring to the game? Who are they guarding? What might change in what's been going on and how to be ready for it? So those are the kind of things that happen in a timeout. But principally towards the end of game scenarios, they are critically important that you're aware of a number of things that can go on, whether the team is in the penalty, when there's a foul to give, whether there's a potential of a take foul. You know, you've got all this going on in your head. And when you're really young in the business, you go, I hope somebody else gets it because I don't know exactly what it is. And you know, the younger people rely on the older ones to help in those coverage areas at times.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Andy, going back to you for a second, I think one of the things that I've liked about some of the FIBA rules around timeouts isn't even necessarily the number, right? But it's the fact that you can't really do live ball timeouts. They always have to be done like after a made basket, for example. And I wonder if that isn't something that could be used to keep the flow of the game high without necessarily sacrificing a certain number of timeouts. Is that something that you'd be interested in?
Yeah, that's interesting. And I think also it has to be called by the coach, right?
Right.
And I actually, there's push and pull with all these, which I think we've established. But if you take away player called timeouts, then you lose a lot of, I think, pretty classic moments in the history of basketball. If that's not available to the players, and it's always been a smart play. If so-and-so saves the ball and is falling out of bounds and calls a timeout before he hits the ground. So it would be
some chaos though, right?
Which is not allowed, you know?
That one has been changed. I don't know if that's still allowed in high school or college. Because I just, frankly, I'm not as up on high school and college changes as I am others. So things change a lot. I think what you just mentioned, Mike, makes some sense. And I think the overall goal is, can we just improve the flow of the game by 5% even? Can we improve it by 10%? Right. If that means going to 5 team called timeouts instead of 7, does that help, you know, that little bit more? I think in general, the amount of stoppages and the length of some stoppages, and I know we're going to get into some of these later when we talk about replays and stuff like that. I think it has a little bit of a negative effect on the casual viewer's experience with basketball.
Well, let's move on to our, go ahead, Ronnie.
No. I agree with Andy saying, I think it's good to look into the timeouts because listen, this 2-hour talk has been around a long time.
Yeah.
And we had to just put it out there. Many years ago, we had officials that played the internal game, not many, a handful, to see how they could actually get the game closest to 2 hours as possible. So you got to sacrifice something if you're trying to get a game to 2 hours. So sometimes our tremendously great just appearance people that refereed the game would be on the court and say, well, when this person referees, there's no use saying anything to him. He's so well respected, nobody's going to say anything. So the problem was, are we letting fouls go that should be a warranted whistle because we don't want to stop the game? So I remember hearing ridiculous talk about some things like that. Like so-and-so got the game down in 205, another guy got it in 210, another guy got it in 203. Wow. And everybody's going, well, let's take a look at these games. You know, this is what I was on the court. And I was, I remember, saying, I don't want to be involved in any kind of nonsense where we're not calling plays because the whistle stops the clock. Okay. Right. It stops the TV clock. It stops the game clock. So anyhow, so it's very hard to get the 2 hours but I'm interested in things like that, that could cut the game. I think there's too many timeouts, really, frankly.
One more thing before you jump back in, Ray, on the 2 hour thing. I think the last time it was a big national discussion point, they might have even tried 10-minute quarters in the G League, if I recall correctly. And I think things that can like really alter historical perspective of the game. I'm not one of those advocates for getting rid of the 82 game schedule. The idea of going from 12-minute quarters to 10-minute quarters was crazy to me. Because I spend a ton of time in my work with Bleacher Report looking at stats and making historical comparisons. Right. And the difference between a 40-minute game and a 48-minute game is pretty dramatic.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think it would be great if they could eventually fit a game into a 2 hour window. I don't know if it's possible without reducing the length of quarters. But I do think there are better paths to that than something quite that dramatic.
Well, money screams.
I would just say to you, Andy, also, the difference in 40 and 48 minutes. I remember when I first started as a junior official in the league, right? I remember Daryl Garrison saying to me, you've got to put quarters together. 48 minutes is very demanding, not only on your body, but your mind, your attention span. And I said, okay, well, how do I get there? He says, one quarter at a time. Worry about, I mean, you may not be yourself in the second quarter. You may have a revival in the third quarter, and then all of a sudden you're worried about the fourth quarter. So, and I think the same amount of stamina is involved with playing. A lot of people play, but when you play a 12-minute NBA quarter, it's a long time to play and have that type of stamina. So you're right about the fact that it's a completely different game between 40 minutes. For example, when I review the EuroLeague games or I review the NBL of Australia, the 10-minute, it kind of is good when I'm reviewing because they say, well, this game is moving and it's done.
Mm-hmm.
But a 48-minute NBA game is a monster. And it's a monster to review, and it's very demanding on players. And by the way, because it's demanding, you get more pulls, tugs, grabs, people that's trying to catch up. So the game has a whole culture to it that affects all of us.
So, Andy, the two-hour proposal, and Ronnie, that you've been speaking about, I think a lot of people, or most people, would probably like to have the game flow improved and the game, and a lot of the things that would be improved in the game. But I kept thinking while you guys were talking about it, and Andy, you kind of alluded to it, is money doesn't talk, it screams. And so the networks and the advertisers, et cetera, you know, your thought about, gee, how do you make up for that lost revenue probably is the most significant factor that comes into play in any decision, regardless of specifics of what it is. You've got to appease the people that are footing the bill. So especially since every year that every time that those are renegotiated, they want those to balloon from what the previous contribution from the networks are. So, yeah. So then let's move on to the next one, which is to me, very interesting. And it's, I think, demanded by just about everybody who watches basketball for a whole host of reasons. But it's, you know, not necessarily that easy, which I think will lead to a real interesting give and take between you and Ronnie. And that's the issue of flopping. It's been quite a number of years now where it's reached, some would say, ridiculous proportions. I remember back when flopping first started, and Ronnie, you can verify this, I hope. Flopping to me started, this is like 50 years ago, because when somebody, an offensive player ran into a defensive player, officials didn't really call it unless they fell over. And as a way of getting attention and demonstrating to the official that actually there was enough contact to affect the play, players started flopping. I remember the famous Mike Newland episode with Dave Cowens where Newland was one of the original floppers and flopped a couple times on negligible contact. And Cowens got so angry that one time that he responded by cold cocking him and smashing him to the floor and said, now, turned to the official and said, now that's a foul. that became a very famous episode. Anyway, how do we deal with the fact that virtually everybody hates to watch flopping because it's like, you know, people refer to, oh, that was an Academy Award play, et cetera, et cetera. So, Andy, what's your proposal? Why is it your proposal? And then, Ronnie, can you respond to it from an official's perspective?
Yeah, I think people who followed me for any amount of time on social media probably know me as the old guy yelling at clouds when it comes to flopping, because I find myself reacting to it on just about every NBA game that I watch, which is nightly during the season. It has become endemic in the NBA, and it's the biggest name players who do it. That LeBron James, Chris Paul, I mean, you name it. There are all the biggest name guys have gotten away with some pretty egregious flops. And I don't know, I don't remember in the article if I even have a specific proposal other than I think the penalties need to be harsher. I know for a long time the league had fines, and I think that policy is still in place. It's just, from my memory, hasn't been used as regularly over the last several years. And I really feel for officials on this front, because if I was trying to officiate a game and I knew these players were actively trying to fool me the whole time, I would be furious about that. So I think there's got to be some kind of harsher penalty. I don't know if you bring back the fines, make them more severe. I have advocated, at least on social media, for suspensions. And I don't think it necessarily has to be the officials who are on the floor in the game who do that. I mean, if there's an egregious flop, maybe the official makes a note of it somewhere and the replay center reviews it after the game or the next day or something, and you levy that punishment later. Because I think adding more and more reasons for the players to yell at the refs is probably not good, because they already get plenty of heat from those guys over the course of a game. So you take it out of their hands, you put it in the league office. I think these NBA players are good enough to, it is habitual with a lot of them, but I do think they could knock it off pretty quickly if they realized, oh shoot, this is going to cost me a game or two. I better stop this. I feel like the problem would change pretty quickly if there were real sanctions involved.
Well, Andy, you're on point there, man. Right in the strike zone. The issue, by the way, talking about international basketball, remember that in international sports is a soccer. I'm bringing that name up again. And there's a lot of flopping that occurs in soccer. So what happened is the behavior of athletes that transition into basketball, they're all soccer players. You know, they grew up in soccer. You know, like we're here in our country, we're you get a ball in a glove, maybe, you know, that's what every national situation is, except now the influence of soccer is so big, it's different than the older days. But the flopping came from let's say the European soccer, and now you have European players, and then they begin to use this technique by sitting on your heels. By the way, you try walking around in your heels and somebody bumps into you, you're gonna move. Sure. And whether you like it or not, you can't, you know, you need the balls of your feet. I like the fact that the NBA, and you alluded to it, began to take, I think you made a very good point, when they took the actual penalty from the official's hands or whistle or technical foul and gave it to the office. In other words, I've got to referee the play. If I think it's a flop, I won't call the foul. If I think it's an offensive foul, I will call the foul. Once that's all adjudicated in the office at the round table, when they're looking at plays and they start comparing what flops look like versus really what offensive fouls look like, then you know, we associate a fine. And you're absolutely right. I thought that was a good idea, because why put another something in the backpack of an official to have to attend to, where all of a sudden it becomes controversial? And it's a controversial play. So I'm for the main adjudicating part of the referee department and whatever else is up there to make that judgment, to one, attach fines to it, suspensions to it. And you know, one thing about money coming out of you, but you know how long it took to go from $500 to $1,000 on technical fouls, and all the bitching, if I can use that word, the players never liked they're making a lot of money, and $500 taken from them was getting them PO'd, you know? So I find that in the NBA culture, if some kind of money is taken out, people get in line. I don't know about the other sports, but they get in line quicker when you're penalized with your money. And of course, some people like to make a show of it. $25,000. So we know we've had coaches do things, and they get, you know, they're making, they're multi-million dollar earners. So $25,000, they're a little PO'd, but they accept it. But I think your idea is a good one, and that's to penalize, probably, you know, at the office level, and then maybe it can come back to where an official can do it because everybody understands what it looks like. Mm-hmm. You know, it's almost like a cyclical thing. Make it harsher now, and then maybe give it back to the officials later. Because in international play, you can get a technical foul, which is, I believe, unsportsmanlike, and you get one more of those, and you're out. You know.
And now, the reason my editors gave me this article is this summer the league did just give the officials the ability to tee players up specifically for flopping, and I think that's good. At least it shows that the league recognizes the problem. Yeah. But it does get back to what you and I have talked about here, that if a ref tees a player up for flopping, it's going to create some tension between he and that player or he and that team. So I think it might be a better, I mean, everybody knows the plays that are terrible flops the moment they happen. And yeah. So it's not hard to refer it to the league office and have them deal with it either after the game or the next day. Whenever the punishment comes, if it's harsh enough, I think players will tone down the flopping a little bit.
You know, I as both of you have indicated, I think it's a great idea to make the main sanction come from the league office for all the reasons that you just discussed. Ronnie, I remember when technical fouls cost $25. I don't know if you remember back that far. It's like,
I remember that.
Yeah. And so yes, I think you make a valid point about money counts, even, you know, even if it's the equivalent of 2 cents for us, for a player. But I do think, as Andy points out, that suspensions hurt and hit a lot harder. And for the most egregious, repetitive sins by players, if we were to have suspensions, I again agree that that's going to be self-regulating. People yeah. are not going to want that to happen to them. Hell, I need to clean up my act. Boy, it was one thing when I had to pay X number of dollars. This is another thing to have me sit out and in fact, you know, lose that game pay. I think that's, and of course, from a team perspective, they're not going to want to lose the ability to have a player play. So, yeah.
Just to add to that, Ray, flopping as we know it traditionally is this, you know, this dislodged situation for a defensive player. He's being dislodged or he's faking being dislodged yeah. one way or the other. The other part about flopping that we forget about, which can create a slippery slope, is you take a guy like Allen Iverson, who's going to the hoop, and he's looking. I used to call him a heat-seeking missile. He's looking for contact. I mean, right. Carmelo Anthony was one of them. When I worked for the Knicks for years, a specialty coach on the foul avoidance, I would tell Carmelo, you're seeking contacts that are not there. And this is a form of flopping, too. This is offensive flopping. Okay, so you'd go for somebody, and then you'd fall to the ground, and you expect somebody to you know, bail you out. So we have offensive flopping during dribbles. If you notice some of the head-up situations that occur, a dribble, and all of a sudden it looks like someone was stopped in their rhythm, speed, balance, or quickness, it was interrupted. The head goes up. These are all artful ways of drawing fouls to an advantage. And, you know, some of the people of basketball, I almost have a mixed feeling about it, not as a referee, just as a fan. You always are incredibly lured in by the artistic ability of athletes. I mean, basketball's got that artful way about it. Besides the rules that are standardized, there's unique ways. I mean, I can even remember Jerry West in my teenage years dribbling, all of a sudden feeling like he got a little bump, but he actually put a little bump further. He bumped himself out of the path that he was in even further to draw a foul. So I think the office, I don't know we have to go that far towards the offense, because the obvious one is the defense, but these are all forms of flopping and artfulness, and some of it I kind of dig, and the other I don't, because it can fool us, and that's what you got to be aware of. Referees can be fooled, and we are all fooled at one time or another, sure. And you got to catch up to people. Coaches will squeal on you. They'll call the office and say, so-and-so takes 4 steps. You've got to look at film. Here's 10 films, and sometimes, guess what? They're right. And we go, wow, we're not noticing this. And as a director, I started seeing, you know, their frustrations as well as some of the things we needed to catch up on. You are never ahead of the players or the coaches. They are always, the wheels are always turning, and we're always behind, and we're always catching up. And that's not a slant on any of the officiating at all.
And of course, coaches are always looking for a loophole in the rules and a way to gimmick the loopholes in the rules. God, remember that horrible, horrible, and it's been reduced significantly, Hack-a-Shaq stuff that, oh my God, did that destroy games?
Right.
So they're always looking for an edge, whether it's make consistent with the spirit of the rules or consistent with the spirit of the game or not, doesn't really matter. And, you know, so they're going to always try. And then there needs to be an appropriate response.
Yeah. And to your point, Ronnie, like it's, and you know, Andy, you alluded to this a little bit too. Like, it's not like flopping is a new art. I think it was Frank Ramsey who wrote an article, you know, formerly of the Celtics, Frank Ramsey wrote an article back in 1963 for Sports Illustrated called Smart Moves by Masters of Deception. And it was all about how to flop and draw fouls. That was 1963. So this is not a new problem. And unfortunately, it's not a totally solvable problem, but I think there are definitely steps that can be made to limit the worst offenses. Right. And I think that's what we'd all like. So I think we have the rest of the conversation be about the block and charge rules and what we could do about that. Ray, does that check out okay for you?
That's fine. And Andy, you did write about banning the block charge. And I thought that you raised it in a couple of different contexts here, one for the primary defender and one for the secondary defender. And maybe you can articulate for us, if you've got multiple proposals that would apply in those each different situation, but exactly what is it you're proposing and why? And of course, previewing Ronnie's response, I know that this is going to be one of the most difficult things that an official has to do. But anyway, Andy, you want to take us there?
This is a big one, Andy. I want to hear this.
This is another one that I've screamed into the void about on the internet. And I will be the first to admit, I don't think there is a perfect answer. I think running into the middle of a play, parking your body, trying to be still, and then falling backwards onto the floor has been coached at every level of basketball for decades now. So I don't think this is a snap of the fingers, it's gone type of a thing. It would be very, very difficult to change. And maybe it's the bias in me as a former big man who got called for a lot of charges that I dislike it so much. But when I watch basketball, what I just described, somebody coming from outside the play into it at the last minute, basically becoming an obstacle, it just doesn't look like a basketball play to me. I think the analogy I used in the article was, imagine you're driving down the road and somebody just chucks a cone in front of your car. You hit the cone and then you get in trouble for, you know, driving into a construction zone or something like that. It has never felt like a natural thing to me for a defender to just sort of appear out of nowhere. And it's also dangerous. Plenty of players who are airborne and then this obstacle appears in front of them. You can get undercut. You can tear an ACL. You can land on your back. You're not ever going to make basketball completely safe. I mean, that's the nature of sports. You expose yourself to injuries, especially when you play on a hardwood surface and you're often off that surface. So I'm not trying to turn basketball into like a safe space or anything like that. But I think maybe I might need some help on this, but what if a player is already airborne, the defender is not supposed to be able to slide under him at that point. Maybe you expand that a little bit and you say, once the player starts his gather, and that certainly doesn't make the official's job easier. It just moves their decision point a little bit one direction or the other. But in some form or fashion, I think we have to get rid of this play where it just doesn't seem like a basketball play to me. And I know that it's taught by basketball coaches all over the world for years and years and years, but it just has always felt so unnatural to me. And in terms of specific proposals, I think the only one I really had was, you got to change that decision point to the gather instead of airborne. And I don't think you can get rid of charging, because the offense already has plenty of advantages as it is, especially in the NBA. And I think we all know a charge when we see it. Like if an offensive player is driving to the rim and he uses his off arm as a battering ram, if you go for a drop step as a post player and your elbow's real high and you clock the guy in the head. I mean, that kind of stuff is obvious. It's this very specific block charge. A guy is driving to the hoop and suddenly a defender appears out of nowhere that I've always struggled with. That's a very long rambling answer. I don't know how many specifics I gave you, but that's just kind of my thoughts on the situation.
Well, I you know, there's pluses and minuses to the rule. And I think, for example, the one that's the easiest is if a player is airborne and all of a sudden somebody slides under, that's the one that should be obvious that is a blocking foul. Okay, that's not a charge. And it's also a dangerous play, to your point. And when you move that play up a little bit, that's one of the reasons for the semicircle. I mean, the restricted area. I mean, people were going in there because it's an old college and high school deal. Maybe I can get a charge at it. As a matter of fact, in the rule, it used to be if you let the ball go first and then hit the guy, if the ball went in, that's good. And then the guy goes down and shoots on the other end. And what crazy high school NCAA rule. And, you know, the NBA certainly cleaned that up, talking about innovation. If it's a charge, it's a charge, it's a charge, whether the ball was released or not, yada, yada, yada. The other piece is when you don't have the ball and you are cutting, a player who elects to screen you must give you an opportunity to stop and change direction. So in that stop, we used to call it the step, you know, a stride. Okay, but instead of calling a stride, and I think the lawyers of the NBA, because I want you to make sure, Andy, you know, the lawyers run the NBA when it comes to and things like that. I used to always get nervous when one of the lawyers of a team would call to run. I want to ask you a question about 0.3 seconds on an out of bounds. I go, here we go. This is why I should have gone to graduate school and got a JD instead of special education and a principal's degree. I you know, whatever. So the bottom line is I like the step not taken out by saying give it a chance to stop. So it has some, you know, ability to judge if the screen is too quick or too fast, or, you know. So that's the easy one. The one I'd like to see changed is a guy is dribbling and all of a sudden the cone goes in front of him. Well, I think you need to give that dribbler a chance to be able to stop or launch upward, you know. Yeah. So as I talk about the launching upward, if it's a shot, you'll find that many players drive to the hoop. Somebody gets there. And I haven't talked about the gather yet. Somebody gets there and he recognizes that he's in trouble because he's going to barrel over somebody. I always thought that if a player could recognize that and instead of going forward, go upward as best way he could and come down softly, almost in that same space, then the guy who's like dying for the, this falls into a little bit of the flopping sit down mode. If mm-hmm. I see that he wants to sit down, then to me, it's to me not a flop, but nothing. It's an opportunity to get the offensive foul call, but he's sitting down hoping that, you know, maybe he'll get a call here and it's a play on. So nobody gets in trouble for that play. You know, years ago, talking about Ray and Brooklyn Tech, I remember an official explaining to the coach that once the player has the gather, once he has a gather, the defense can no longer be there. And by the way, the gather got better because some kids could gather from the free throw line, take two steps. So the guy would gather, or before he gathered, or right at that point, the defender would be there waiting. And everybody knows he's waiting. And this is no Euro step or anything they're talking about. And he goes, he takes a step and he goes over him and they go, absolutely a block. Block? Yes, because he wasn't there when the gather occurred. Now, you talked about distance. Mm-hmm. Well, obvious is everybody in the world goes, block? That's got to be an offensive foul. The guy's been standing there like the Statue of Liberty for God knows how long. Okay, so what have they do? They started to creep in that path. So where did they creep it into? Once the player gathers the ball in the form of going upward, he may have previously gathered it, but once his upward motion is going, you got to be there before that upward motion. And that constitutes a driving offensive foul. If you're there later than the time he goes upward by sliding in, he hasn't gotten into the air yet, but he's on his way up. If you slide in when he's on his way up, it should be a defensive foul. So that's where it is. By the way, that's where it came from such a long time ago. They decreased the space and time to draw defensive fouls. Now, listen, there are a lot of teams that don't have a lot of talent in college, high school, or pro. Yeah. And all the defensive coaches are going to say, hey, you know, when are you going to allow the defense to give them, you know, how many times I would hear a coach, Ronnie, this guy's working hard on defense. You're not crediting him with the hard work. It's not all offense. It's defense to this game. So there's a point for the defensive people. And by the way, they bring that point up when they have no offense. And, or just like Don Nelson would say, I don't know, I want to change the three-second rule because of this, that, or the other. Or Manute Bol is in there with a wide span. And are we going to change defensive threes? Because he's really he's really fingers away from either side of the lane line for so long. So, you know, all these little nuances come from the player's uniqueness of their abilities. But I don't think you can change the block charge too much. I like the way it is, but I would like the dribbler to be able to stop. If somebody just jumps in front of a dribbler, you notice a lot of guys just, they like, this is an accident. This is the, I think you make a great simulation there about the cone going in front of a street and all of a sudden you're putting on your brakes, you know. So yeah. I think that play, I'd love to see that play. Does that dribble have a chance to stop? And that means he gets a step. Go ahead.
I really like that idea, and I hadn't thought of it, so I'm glad I got the opportunity to talk to you. I think give him an opportunity to stop is big. Another thing that you mentioned that I've heard, you know, other proponents of getting rid of block charge or changing it is expanding the restricted area, which has always been kind of interesting to me. And then the only other thought I had on this topic is I still play pickup basketball a couple times a week. I don't know if anybody else here does, but nobody ever tries to take a charge in pickup basketball. And I don't think it really changes the way the game is played. Instead of trying to run in front of somebody and park your butt there and then fall over, you try and actually defend the shot. You go up and you try and block it, or you try and strip him before he goes up, or you go vertical. And I certainly wouldn't want NBA basketball to completely mirror my pickup games, because that's going to get pretty ugly. But that's another point that I think it's just, I've never seen that play as a natural basketball behavior, even though we've basically engineered it to be.
You know, I think the play can still be around if we can call it correctly. You know, the block charge was the impetus to the term that Daryl Garrettson created and I followed and all of us follow, is to referee the defender. You know, we may miss some walks sometimes. Obviously, the palming is out of hand here, but if you referee the defender, you can always go backwards to get the offense. You can always figure out what the offense did. Did he extend the knee? Did he do a wipeout? Mm-hmm. If you get that defender, you have the timing and the play actually with your eyes, which we all don't do. But if you see a driving player and you're looking for either the primary guy or the secondary guy from weak side out, which is a big thing in basketball, if you can catch him and find out where he goes and when he stops, then you've got him. The same with the screener. You got him. But if you're looking at the wrong people and then somebody comes at the stop sign and we don't know if that person came to a stop or not, now we've lost the play. So refereeing the defense and training your eyes to ref the defense is completely different than, you know, I try to tell referees, when you watch a game, I want you to start refereeing the defense. Look at the defense. He's going to tell you what's legit and what's illegit. And by the way, going back with some history, Ray, maybe you can comment on this too. There was, Boston and the Celtics, thinking about the Renaissance group here in New York, the Rens. We never went back that far, right? But
not even I go back that far, but yes. But except as a historian.
Red Auerbach recognized on fast breaks, and he started instituting fast breaks, obviously, during the Celtics 60s time. One of the things to combat that fast break, of course, you know, the original fast break, and Andy, I'm sure you can appreciate this as well, is the rebounder gets it, and he looks for the lanes to throw it out. And create the fast break, the three, you know, the dribbler and the two lane people. Well, they started noticing that's what Red was doing, and they started putting people in the lanes. So a guy would be running, and this is a terrible play. He's looking over his shoulder to see if he's going to get the outlet pass, and all of a sudden, he knocks over a guy, and the referee says, "Jesus, this guy's been standing here. It's an offensive foul." Well, to my understanding, and it's not just folklore, Red and I are both GW graduates. He once told me, said that he complained and said, we cannot have that play in basketball by someone who's in the half court game. Yes. You got to know where you're going in the full court transition. If you're in a lane and the guy is running and he's looking for the outlet pass and he knocks you over, it's going to be a blocking foul. And it was a very interesting concept. I never asked David or anybody else more about that. I asked Red about that. Red said to me, yeah, I was the one that spoke it. Of course, I knew Red would say that. He said, because it's dangerous to the game. It's dangerous to the game. Full speed running into a pole and not noticing that the guy is there. I always look for that play, and I'm glad it doesn't exist. But if it ever comes up while I'm still alive, I'm going to make sure we have a rule that you cannot do that, except during the half court, front court game. You got to know where you're going in the front court. Although we have alley-oops and things like that, too, to be dangerous if you don't pick it up. But that was a very interesting thing about block charge, by the way. Off the ball, block charges on a fast break. Had you guys ever heard that before?
That I still feel like I see that play occasionally.
Yes.
Particularly when a guy gets the ball and he's turning to dribble up the floor. I'll see a lot of KG defenders think, oh, I'm going to go get a charge here real quick.
With the ball.
With the ball. I don't see it as often with
– On the catch, maybe.
Yeah, looking for the ball and then hitting the guy.
Ronnie, I'm wondering if that became – with Red's powerful comments at those times, I wonder if that became part of a culture. We did not know where it came from or where it ended, but that he complained about that. And, of course, listen, the Celtics were known for their fast breaks ability, and they had the player personnel to do it.
Ronnie, I've noticed sometimes in the half court, when a player passes the ball and a defender then steps into his continuation lane because he no longer has the ball and he's no longer even thinking about.
It's the pass and crash deal.
Right? Pass and crash. Yeah.
Yeah. And because the game has become with more data and more, I guess the game is trying to be more honest. The game is always trying to be more honest to the game. I get that. And they think that the control of a passer is the same as the control of a dribbler. You just can't – listen, there was a time in my early years in the NBA we allowed pass and crash because it had no effect on the play, really. The play is out there in the corner for the shot or the dish, and this guy is just standing in the way, as Andy is saying, we don't need this play. And so that we would pass on it as a cultural thing. But all of a sudden, people get up and go, that's a charge, isn't it? And the guy ran him over, isn't it? Well, yeah, well, why don't you guys call it? And all of a sudden, here we go. And the culture changes because, according to the rule, we don't have anything like, by the way, passing crashes don't count. Oh, okay, so we don't have to worry about it. So either you make these unique things and say, we're not going to do pass and crash and let it go, to Andy's point about eliminating a part of a block charge play, or you say, listen, you're responsible for the behaviors of your body, regardless of what you do. And it's safer, I think the lawyers believe, it's safer to keep it consistent everywhere because that's how you can defend it.
Yeah, and also I think it's important to be consistent because if the rule says something and then there's a decision made that, okay, sometimes we're going to call it according to the rule and sometimes we're not, that just confuses everybody.
Yeah.
So I think here is probably a good place to cut our conversation short. You know, as always, listening to Andy and Ronnie talk about this, I gain further appreciation for just how intricate an NBA referee's job really is and how many variables are going through their minds at any given moment. And I hope that the listeners will agree. It's an interesting peek behind the curtain a little bit. Before we go, Andy, I want to give you guys a quick moment to plug your stuff. Where can people find you? What are you up to now? Andy, you want to go first?
Sure. I have stuff that goes up on Bleacher Report a couple times a week. If you click on NBA content, you've probably clicked on me, and that's where I've been for a long time. So thank you for having me, guys.
Yeah.
You know, I do a referee camp called nonebetterrefs.com. People can get to me on that. And it's really teaching something that I've been a student of for so long. It's the best thing I know. It's the only thing I know better than playing and coaching is refereeing. Whoever would have thought that I would have attached myself to embrace it as I do, because I came late to it. And I learned about it. And by the way, when I give clinics to young people, I talk to them, Andy, about all the other branches to being involved in sport and being a writer as you are. And it's just tremendous, because, especially as a player writer, because those words are going to come out and make sense to people. So congratulations on the work you do.
Appreciate it. Thank you.